The Solid Monster sounds off.
Hulk Hogan has definitely been that rocket fuel that TNA needed.
This doesn't make any sense.
Your title belt is made of leather. You're not a real vegan.
Seth, you haven't been beat up properly. Woo!
Welcome to episode 301 of the Solid Monster Sounds Off for Sunday, November 17th, 2013. I am the Solid Monster. You can listen to this show each and every week on thesolidmonster.com, Stitcher Radio, and iTunes, and download our free app in the Google Play Store if you have an Android device. I want to say thank you right off the bat to everybody who wrote in, emailed me, sent in tweets about the big anniversary show last weekend, episode 300. It was a big milestone for me, a big milestone obviously for the show, and was pretty well received, and I just wanted to say thank you for that. WrestleMania tickets are on sale right now for those looking to attend next year's big event in New Orleans. I got my ticket, so it is official. I will be attending my third consecutive WrestleMania. But let's be honest here. The real hot ticket is going to be the Raw the night after WrestleMania. That's the show to really look forward to. Take it from me. I've been to the Raw post-Mania in Miami and in New Jersey earlier this year, and both times I had more fun than I did at WrestleMania itself. So I don't know when those Raw tickets go on sale. I don't even know where Raw is going to be. It'll be somewhere, I guess, in New Orleans next year. But wherever it is, if you're going to WrestleMania, make sure you go to Raw the next night because you will regret it if you don't. I want to give some PayPal shout-outs to some of our loyal listeners who have donated this week. Shout-outs go out to Andrew Aspey, Colin Kayer, and Adam Massaglia. And in addition to donating to the Sound Off, or perhaps in lieu of doing so this week, I would ask that you consider making a donation to the Red Cross for the victims of Typhoon Haiyan, which has wreaked havoc in the Philippines. Just a devastating storm, one of the worst to ever hit that region. I think last count was almost 4,000 dead that we know of. Many more homeless in need of food and supplies. So if you'd like to donate, you can do so over at redcross.org. It was brought to my attention by a few listeners this week that Diamond Dallas Page was on the Busted Open radio show on Sirius and was talking about a whole litany of different subjects. He was talking about Jake the Snake, Scott Hall, obviously a lot of the work that he's done with them in the accountability crib. And one thing that he mentioned, he went out of his way to mention this on the show, and this was with respect to Jake Roberts, was a column that he had read some time ago on JBL's website, that of course being layfieldreport.com. And it turns out he was referring to a column that I had written back in May. Now, you may recall I did a whole article making the pitch for why Jake the Snake Roberts should be in the 2014 Royal Rumble. And a lot of people probably feel the same way. I know there are people out there who have no interest in seeing Jake Roberts in the Rumble. I got some feedback from people saying it's a terrible idea, he's old, he's washed up, blah, 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 because they just don't get it. But my idea was a little bit different than probably other things you may have heard, may have read, in that I don't think it should be a surprise. And I laid out this whole idea for how they could go about getting Jake Roberts involved in the Rumble and at the same time take advantage of the publicity that they could get from it. Because, you know, Jake has been put through the ringer for years now. We all know the problems that this guy has had. It's a miracle he's even walking around alive today, considering some of the stuff that he's put himself through and he's put into his body. And, you know, DDP specifically mentioned that in this column, the idea was pitched for Jake to be in the Rumble, but for it to be announced in advance. And it was really cool to hear him, you know, talk about that and give props to it. And even though I wrote that column, I mean, at this point, it was probably 6 months ago or maybe longer, I still support the idea. My mind has not changed. I still feel the same way now that I did back in May when I wrote that column. And it's not too late. It's not too late for WWE to do something like this, even though there's no indication that they actually will. And part of what DDP was talking about in the interview is Jake has been making no bones about the fact that he wants to be in the Royal Rumble. He's been shouting it from the highest rooftops. And if anything, he's probably doing himself no favors by constantly mentioning it and harping on it and trying to get people online to sign petitions to support him being in the Rumble. And even DDP in the interview was like, you know, he has to kind of tell Jake to pull back a little bit. You know, if you're going to be in the Rumble, it'll probably be a surprise and you'll be the last person to know. I mean, you'll be getting a phone call from them 3 or 4 days in advance. Like, just cool your jets. Take it easy. But like I said, I still support the idea. I think WWE would be foolish not to at least consider it. Because for everything that Jake has been through, Jake is one of those guys from way back when that you hear the name Jake the Snake, and you know who that is. You've heard of that name. There's only some names from back in the day that are like that. Obviously, everybody knows who Hulk Hogan is. Andre the Giant is almost a cliche term that people still use to this day, even who aren't wrestling fans. You hear people use that phrase. I think other names like the Ultimate Warrior, the Macho Man, and maybe Mr. Perfect to a lesser degree, but I've heard people who aren't wrestling fans, or at least not anymore, anchors on ESPN, they use Jake the Snake. They use that nickname a lot. So he's a known name from back in the day, and I think even with fans today who have absolutely no idea who Jake Roberts is, and it would be hard because I think he's been in the video games, they did a DVD about him many years ago, but I'm sure there's younger fans, newer fans who maybe don't know who he is. The way that I would do it is you start airing these vignettes on television. You make the initial announcement that Jake the Snake Roberts is going to be part of the 30-man Royal Rumble match in January. Now, when you do this, I don't know. Pick a week sometime after Survivor Series. That's why the timing of this is still perfect. I wouldn't say anything until after Survivor Series is already over. I know you have the TLC show, but the next big show after the one next Sunday is going to be the Rumble. So maybe 2 weeks from now, 3 weeks from now at the most, you make the announcement. You air a video on Raw with some clips and highlights from Jake's career, and then the big announcement that he's going to be part of the Rumble. And you give people a little backstory about what, you know, the guy's career, but what he's been through. You know, Jake has had his demons, he's had his battles, he's been a punchline for a number of years in wrestling. He went from the highest of highs to the lowest of lows. And now it's really cool to see that he's worked his way back up where he's gotten his life back. You know, he's looking as good as he's looked in years. He's feeling good. He's getting his life together. And it's this great dream of his to walk out and make one more appearance at the Royal Rumble and get that big reaction from the crowd, you know, and bust out one more big DDT. And I think a lot of people would love to see it. Now, I'm not saying that Jake Roberts should be the feature attraction of the Royal Rumble, by no means. But I see nothing wrong with promoting him as like a little side deal that gets people a little bit more excited in that pay-per-view. You know, you can have your big, whatever the big main event's going to be. The Rumble match itself is always a big deal. It's probably my second favorite show of the whole year. But knowing that Jake the Snake is making his big comeback in the Rumble is a cool little side story. I think that may even get some people to buy the show who otherwise would not. And what's in it for WWE, in terms of doing this and announcing it in advance, and you could air video packages on television, not every week, but maybe skip a week here and there, and you show footage of him in you know, DDP's house. I don't think he's living there anymore. I believe he's since moved out. But DDP's got a ton of footage. I mean, he's been filming these guys from the moment they set foot in that house. They're working on some sort of documentary. And the video footage is very professionally shot. I don't think, you know, I know WWE can be a stickler for good production values. I don't see anything wrong with these videos that DDP's been putting out. They look very slick, professionally done. You supply some footage of Jake in the house from when he first entered. He looked like crap. He was well over 300 pounds, could barely move. His life was in shambles. And you chronicle his journey from what he was then over a year ago to where he is today. He's lost like over 60 or 70 pounds. He's doing the yoga. He's got like a vegetable garden in the backyard. He's taking his life back. And you intersperse that with clips of him from over his career. And it's a great story. People love that. People love a good comeback story, a good story of redemption. And you build it and you build it and you build it. And the best thing for WWE, I can't imagine, unless their PR people are this bad, and they're not. They've got good people working for them. How can you not get Jake the Snake on something like the Today Show or Good Morning America or some big radio shows and other? You can get some really cool publicity out of this. Jake goes out of his way whenever he does interviews to give credit to WWE and to Vince McMahon about how they saved his life. You know, all those times he went to rehab, that was on WWE's dime. He went to the company-sponsored rehab multiple times, and he's given credit to the company for basically saving his life. It's not something the company has to push themselves, like, hey, look at us, like those videos, when they do those videos about all the charity things they do on TV. Yeah, they do a lot of good stuff, but you know, it's like they're kissing their own ass. They don't have to do that. Jake will do it for them. He'll gladly go out there and share his story and tell people, hey, listen, you know, this company, I wouldn't be here right now if it wasn't for what these guys did for me. And at the end of every interview, you get, you know, the anchor to go, oh, by the way, you can see Jake the Snake at the Royal Rumble on, you know, whatever the date is and whatever the city is on pay-per-view. It's great promotion for the event, too. Because, I mean, really, you're not going to get a lot of mainstream publicity for the Royal Rumble unless you have some sort of celebrity appearance, right? Everything is usually reserved for WrestleMania. Why not get a little extra pub, mainstream pub out of it for the Rumble? So then Jake gets to go out there. He gets I'm sure he'll get a great reaction from the crowd, whatever city that show is in. And it's very simple, okay? It's very simple. I don't want to see Jake the Snake, 60 years old, going in the Rumble and having an even-handed, you know, fist fight with CM Punk or Daniel Bryan, okay, or another main event guy. He goes in there, and as I pitched, I think, in the original column, you do something with him and 3MB. Heath Slater is the perfect person for him to interact with. Heath Slater, they trust Heath Slater. I still remember when they brought Bret Hart back in 2010, and they were doing the battle between John Cena's, you know, team WWE guys and the Nexus heading into SummerSlam. And on Raw, multiple times, whenever Bret would get into, you know, fisticuffs with a member of the Nexus, it was pretty much always Heath Slater. Always. He was the one. Like, he was the Bret Hart guy. Bret could go to him, and Slater would protect him, and he would bump really well for him. Even when they did the big 10-man tag at SummerSlam that year, and Bret got in the ring for a few minutes, the guy he worked with was Heath Slater. You know, last year, before Raw 1000, they did that whole angle where they would bring back legends. They brought back Vader and Sid and some other guys. Who was the person they worked with? Heath Slater. Because he's easy to work with. He's safe. He bumps well. He's the perfect person for Jake to get in there with. Him and his 3MB guys. And you could do a deal where Jake gets to do one last DDT. And he gives Slater the DDT, ends up throwing him out. He gets one token elimination. And then you have the other 3MB guys or some other guys very safely dispose of Jake over the top rope and eliminate him. And he gets a nice reaction on his way to the back. And there you go. It's a feel-good moment, a little side story in the Rumble. The other thing is, this would dovetail very nicely into WrestleMania next year because Jake the Snake has been a name that has often been talked about for the Hall of Fame. Jake actually was inducted into the Cauliflower Alley Club Hall of Fame earlier this year. And that's a big deal. Because that's a real Hall of Fame. You compare that to WWE, you know, it's at the whims of Vince McMahon, who goes in, who doesn't. I mean, that's your peers. You know, they vote you into the Hall of Fame. That's a much bigger deal, probably, to a lot of these guys. And they inducted Jake into their Hall of Fame earlier this year because they recognized that this guy has had a Hall of Fame career. His impact on the wrestling business has been such that he deserves recognition. Even for all the BS that he's been through and all the embarrassing situations, he's a Hall of Famer. And I think he definitely belongs in the WWE Hall of Fame. It doesn't matter that he never won a championship. Who cares? It's not about that. It's about his contribution to wrestling. It's about his contribution to the company. Jake, to me, will go down as one of the best promo guys in the history of that company, and he never even held a championship. So does he deserve to go in? Absolutely. And it just so happens that WrestleMania this year is in Louisiana. That's where Jake got his start in his career in the 70s, was in Louisiana. He was all over that Mid-South Wrestling DVD that just came out. And WrestleMania is right in the heart of that region this year. So if ever there was a time and a place, this would be it. The guy's got his act together for now. Is that going to last? Who knows? We've been down this road before with him and other guys that have had problems. All I know is he seems to be doing very well right now. And again, with Mania being in Louisiana, you strike while the iron's hot. Hype up the Rumble appearance, get some publicity out of it. He gets his feel-good moment at the pay-per-view, and then you put him in the Hall of Fame in April. Makes sense to me. We're now 1 week away from what has traditionally been regarded as one of the big four pay-per-views in WWE. Survivor Series, 7 days away, next Sunday in Boston. As of this moment, as I am recording this show, and let it be known I am recording this the day before the go-home edition of Raw. So tomorrow night is the final Raw before Survivor Series. And as of right now, we have three matches on the card, none of which are a traditional Survivor Series elimination match. I know they don't do a full pay-per-view of them anymore. Usually you get at least one. Right now, we have none. And the current lineup looks like this. Randy Orton defending the WWE Championship against The Big Show in the main event. John Cena defending the World Heavyweight title against Alberto Del Rio. And the tag team of CM Punk and Daniel Bryan challenging the Wyatt Clan, Luke Harper and Eric Rowan. That's it. That is your Survivor Series card 1 week in advance of the pay-per-view. Now, my expectation is that on Raw this week, they're going to change the Punk-Bryan match to a traditional elimination match, or they'll add an elimination match of some kind. I would think that would be the one, though, that would make the most sense, especially judging by the end of Raw last Monday, which I thought was awesome. That was one of the most exciting endings to Raw that I've seen all year. I loved the end of that show on Monday. The rest of the show, not so much, but the ending I thought was just superb. And they left you with the impression that you were going to get a 4-on-4, or maybe even as big as a 6-on-6 if they wanted to do like a super Survivor Series elimination match with Punk and Bryan, Goldust and Cody, and the Usos against the Shield and the Wyatts. And even if Bray Wyatt is still hurt, we haven't really seen him wrestling much. He got physical on Monday, but he hasn't wrestled the match, so he may still be hurt. I think it was a bad calf bruise that he suffered at the end of the month last month. If he still can't go, it's fine. If you have a 4-on-4, 6-on-6 elimination match, he can stand on the apron. He doesn't have to do much. So the idea of having a kind of a Super Survivor Series match like that was exciting. I would love to see all six of those guys in the ring together, even though that's probably half the roster right now, putting all those guys in one match. But so what? You put all those guys in one match, and you let them go out there for 30 or 35 minutes. Instead of filling the card with a bunch of meaningless singles and tag matches, you have one match that is exciting that the fans can actually get behind. Certainly, the fans in the UK on Monday were totally into the end of that show on Monday night. And was it just a UK thing? Would they have gotten the same reaction in some random city in the US? Maybe not. Maybe not. But I certainly looked at what we saw there on Monday, and I was excited. And if you look at that, that's the future right there. You look at the faces that were involved at the end of that show. I know Punk's not going to be around maybe for another 10 years. I mean, Bryan might be. I don't know that Punk is the future per se. He's kind of the face of this generation, not of the previous one. But you look at the Shield, you look at the Wyatts, you look at Cody, maybe even the Usos to a lesser degree. These are the faces that you're going to see more of as time goes on. The Shield and the Wyatts, that is the future of this company. Like it or not, get used to it. Because those are the faces you're going to see going forward. And are they all going to make it? Probably not, but some of them will. So like I said, you got to get used to it. And to see all of them and the fans are behind them, and you see Bryan on the ropes at the end of the show as they fade to black, basically telling the heels to come on back. It really is a shame he doesn't have the title right now. If he had the title, he can almost be the representative, I guess, of this current era, but I guess that ship has sailed. But it was still cool to see him and everybody else end the show on Monday. So they got you really excited for that, and then they went and announced the tag match. I tend to believe that on Raw this week, and again, I'm recording this show the day before the final Raw, they're going to change it. They have to. They would be fools not to change that match to some sort of Survivor Series elimination match. Give us that one token elimination match. They've got features right now all over WWE.com about, you know, what are your favorite traditional Survivor Series matches, and they're ranking, I think, like the best ones, and they're throwing it in your face that Survivor Series is all about the elimination matches, and yet we have none on the card for this year. So I'm almost positive that match is going to change. And if it does, then that's something to look forward to on the pay-per-view. But right now there is nothing. And you look at the two title matches, and I don't know what they're thinking. If the idea was, okay, the last three pay-per-views really haven't done that well. SummerSlam was a disappointment in terms of the buy rate. Night of Champions did not do well. Battleground did not do well. I guess early estimates for Hell in a Cell, it's still early, but I don't think that show did particularly well either. They really wanted to make Survivor Series special. You would think so. You would think they would want to. There is nothing special about Survivor Series this year. And I normally don't go ahead and tell people what to do. I usually say, listen, you know, make up your own mind. I can't tell you how to spend your money. Well, I'm going to change that this time. Because if this card doesn't really change all that much, they're going to add matches. These won't be the only matches on the show. But it all depends on what matches they add. And we'll find out on Monday what those matches are. But as of right now, I look at this show, this is a highly skippable show. If somebody came to me and said, what should I do? I'm on the fence. I like Survivor Series. I want to see Punk and Bryan against the Wyatts. I would say to them, that's a match you can get for free on Raw or SmackDown. There is nothing special about a normal tag match with Punk and Bryan against Luke Harper and Eric Rowan. Why are you going to spend $50 on that? Why would you spend $50 to see John Cena and Alberto Del Rio, a match we've seen a million times before, and a match that a lot of people, judging by the emails I've gotten, don't care about? I certainly don't care. And I have no problem with John Cena matches. I think more often than not, John Cena delivers when it comes to pay-per-view matches. He's had some really great matches, but Del Rio? I don't know anybody who's excited about Alberto Del Rio. I'd rather watch paint dry right now than Del Rio, and I don't quite know why. He's not a bad wrestler. There's just nothing about him that gets me excited to see him wrestle. Sheamus kind of fell into the same camp. Maybe when Sheamus comes back, he'll be refreshed, or they'll turn him heel, they'll do something different with him, and I'll feel differently. Sheamus was supposed to be like the number two or three babyface in the whole company, and most of the time, Sheamus would have really, really good matches. But there was something about the guy, right up until the point he got hurt and had to have surgery, I just didn't care. There are just guys like that, and Del Rio fits into that mold that I just don't give a shit. So there's nothing about Cena versus Del Rio that screams, main event, you know, pay for me. Which brings us to the actual main event, Randy Orton and Big Show, which was an undercard match on pay-per-view 8 months ago. Big Show, 14 years after he won the title at the same pay-per-view, is now headlining again for the championship. I have no interest in seeing Randy Orton and the Big Show again. Why is Randy Orton and Big Show the main event of Survivor Series in 2013? This is a pay-per-view that is highly skippable, and it didn't have to be. Survivor Series maybe, you know, Survivor Series is never going to be a top two pay-per-view for the company every year. It lost a lot of that luster. Survivor Series, in effect, died many years ago. There's really been nothing special about the show for a long time, with the exception of 2 years ago when they brought The Rock back. That was at Madison Square Garden. It was The Rock's first match in 8 years. That show felt special. There was something about that show that felt like a big deal. And I was there that night. It had a big feel to it. Aside from that show in 2011, I can't remember the last time Survivor Series felt special. Maybe the last time they were at the Garden. In 2002. Ironically, Big Show won the belt that night, too. And this is on WWE. I think they've done an absolutely horrendous job of promoting this show. Absolutely horrendous. This is a totally skippable show. I would tell people, save your money. Skip a month, save your money, see what lineup they put together for TLC, because they've had some really good TLC shows before. Last year, I was there at the Barclays Center in Brooklyn for TLC, and that show had two tremendous main events, John Cena and Dolph Ziggler in that ladder match, with Ziggler beating Cena and AJ doing the turn. And boy, a lot of good that did for Dolph Ziggler's career. What a waste. What a waste of a win for him over John Cena, considering what they've done with him since then. Why they even had him beat John Cena that night, looking back, I don't even know. And that same night, they had the match of the year in WWE in 2012. They had that big six-man tag. It was the Shield's first match after they debuted at Survivor Series. First pay-per-view match, at least. It was the Shield against Ryback, Daniel Bryan, and Kane. That match was unbelievable. It was so much fun. It was a great match. That was actually a really excellent show. Save your money. Maybe they'll put together another excellent lineup for that show like they did last year. But for Survivor Series, you know, again, traditionally one of their biggest shows of the year, they've done a horrendous job. If this wasn't Survivor Series, if this was some other normal B show, it would still be a horrendous job of promoting this show. There is nothing right now about Survivor Series at all that screams to me, oh, I have to order this show. Nothing. Not one thing about it. And hopefully after Raw this week, they'll change that match. It'll be a traditional Survivor Series. They'll get some more bodies in there. And they could really capitalize off that hot ending to the show this past week. That was something people wanted to see. All of those guys work well together. The Shield works well with almost anybody. Cody and Goldust, they've been on fire lately. The Usos, really cool to see them getting more TV time and actually having a role on the show, not just because, you know, one of them is on Total Divas. Like Tyson Kidd. When Total Divas runs its course, I don't know that we're going to see much of Tyson Kidd on TV. So enjoy him while he lasts. The Usos, they've really, you know, the fans have taken to them. And at some point, I think we will see them win the tag titles. I think that's cool. I think they're really good. All of these guys are good. I'd love to see them in one big Survivor Series match. You give those guys 30 minutes. You know, you can build up each fall. And if you want to have it come down to Punk and Bryan against four guys, it's like four on two. That's the whole aspect of these Survivor Series matches that I love. It's the drama, right? You never know if it's going to come down to a four-on-one handicap situation, or in this case, maybe six-on-one or something. And, you know, you've got a lot of different ways you can go with it. You can even build certain things that maybe will hint at some WrestleMania matches. Maybe there's some dissension between, you know, the heels. There's been rumors of maybe them putting the Shield in a match against the Wyatts if they don't break the Shield up before WrestleMania. I wouldn't mind seeing that. After what we saw Monday, if they build it up the right way, the Shield and the Wyatts, that could be a really big match on the undercard at WrestleMania. Hopefully this week they'll do the right thing. They'll change that match and give us something to get excited about, because right now Survivor Series is a bust. If you're as disillusioned as I am with the way they've promoted some of these shows and the fact that it's Big Show and Randy Orton in the main event, send them a message. Save your money. Don't buy this pay-per-view. And maybe if enough people do that, they'll get the message. Raw was live in Manchester this past Monday night. Great crowd, by the way, in Manchester. They would get really quiet for the stuff that they weren't interested in, but it was all the stuff that nobody could have cared about anyway. Like, they had a match between Damian Sandow and Kofi Kingston, Dolph Ziggler against Curtis Axel. You know, WWE has done nothing to get us to care about any of the guys in those matches, and they have made sure the way that they've booked them that we don't care about them, so I can't blame the UK fans for that. I thought the fans were great throughout the show. Show opened with Randy Orton telling us that Triple H and Stephanie were away on vacation, and so he had the power on this night. This brought out Brad Maddox, you know, that Raw GM guy. Maddox actually got a great reception from the crowd, and I'm not quite sure why. Maybe they thought he was very well-dressed. I don't know. He told Orton, hold on a minute, I'm the Raw GM, and so therefore, I have the power to make matches. So this brought out Libertarian Kane, the new director of operations, who said, no, I have the power, and then he tried to make a match. So they all argued and they bickered back and forth. And finally, Vicky Guerrero, who is the GM of SmackDown, came out and made a handicap match with Randy Orton against Cody and Goldust, and I guess that was taken as gospel because that's the match that we ended up getting. And you wonder why I rag on authority figures in wrestling. None of this made any sense at all, especially that the SmackDown GM can interrupt everybody from the director of operations to the actual Raw general manager and make matches on Raw. Sure, why not? You know, they should just go ahead and book a Survivor Series match. Forget the Punk and Bryan stuff I just talked about. Just make a Survivor Series elimination match this year with all authority figures. They've got enough of them to fill up two teams. You could have Triple H, Stephanie, Vicky, Maddox, Kane. Orton said he was in charge, right? So throw him in there too. And don't forget JBL, because he's the NXT GM. It'll be the first ever intergender Survivor Series elimination match. You got so many damn authority figures, you may as well just put them all in there at once. So we had Orton against the Rhodes Brothers handicap match, which was pretty good for the time it lasted, until Orton just decided to leave, so they did the walkout finish with him instead of Fandango for a change. Big Show came down. Big Show didn't look too good here. He was moving around pretty gingerly. I guess there was that report that he may have suffered some sort of leg injury while on the European tour. He was telling everybody he was okay, but I don't know. He was moving around pretty slow here, but This was one of the better parts of the show in that he gave Randy Orton a chokeslam. And we don't get to see the Big Show do chokeslams too often these days. He's pretty reliable on the knockout punch. That's kind of his big move now. The chokeslam, when he does it, is almost relegated as a setup move. But he brought the ring steps over to the announce desk and climbed up on the steps, had Randy Orton in his grasp, and he hoisted Orton way up into the air and chokeslammed him through the announce table. That was a big bump that Orton took. And visually, it looked great, and the people loved it. So I thought that was actually really cool. And the funniest part about this is, as Big Show leaves, he gets into one of these, British cabs, and I don't know how he even fit himself in there. I mean, he had to crouch down. He looked like a packed sardine in the back of this cab. He told the guy, oh, find me a place to go have a pint. and they drove off. But it was comical watching Big Show try to fit himself into this cab. Santino Marella and Los Matadores beat 3MB. Yes, the Matadores and 3MB again. No mas. No mas. Please. Enough already. 3MB was out there calling themselves the Union Jacks. They could call themselves the Apple Jacks for all I care. I don't give a shit. Just end this program already. The good guys won. Tea Time with Santino was still the best thing he ever did in that country, in my opinion. Maybe the best thing he ever did anywhere, for that matter. Watching Sheamus almost break character laughing was just highly entertaining. Damian Sandow beat Kofi Kingston, which I mentioned earlier, and Curtis Axel pinned Dolph Ziggler cleanly. No interference or anything. One of the biggest goobers on the roster, Axel, and he beat Ziggler all by himself. I can't imagine why the crowd would be so silent for four guys who WWE has conditioned its fans to believe are losers. Can't imagine why. We learned the theme for this Monday's Raw show will be Raw Country, since they'll be in Nashville. So if you're not a fan of country music, this might be a show you want to watch on DVR and fast forward through the parts you don't like. I think they already announced one country music band, I think, is going to be making an appearance. They may be performing on the show, I don't know. I heard Raw Country, and I thought to myself, maybe a foreshadowing of Mickie James' return. You know, Miss Hardcore Country herself. That was her theme song in TNA. She had her own album. She did the whole Hardcore Country song. It would kind of fit with the theme. Mickie was training Divas all this week at the Performance Center in Orlando. They invited her. She accepted. And she came and she worked with the other women. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean anything. They had Eve Torres at the Performance Center doing the same thing last month. But could be a good place for her to come back. They do need a new opponent for AJ because this stuff with the Bellas is totally played out at this point. And it's obvious to me that they're never really going to do anything with Natalya. Even if they started to build Natalya, I'm kind of over it. Part of the problem is they do these start and stop pushes where they'll start pushing somebody and it looks like they're going to get a title match or they're going to do something with them, and then they stop. And I think Natalya kind of falls into the same camp where I just don't care. I'd rather they bring in some new faces, either from developmental, or bring back somebody like Mickie James and put her in a program with AJ. I think that could be very entertaining. Tamina beat Nikki Bella in a brutal match. This was a taped show, and the fact that this match was as ugly as it was, I can only imagine what it must have looked like live without any editing at all. This was terrible. Fandango beat Tyson Kidd. They aired footage from an episode of Total Divas with some contrived nonsense to build heat, I guess, between the two of them. Like I said, Kidd's getting some FaceTime on Raw. Good for him. Enjoy it while it lasts. Match was fine, but I could have done without the Total Divas garbage. R-Truth pinned Ryback with a roll-up. Rumors of a Ryback babyface turn have to be true, because if they aren't, and he's been reduced to just doing jobs for R-Truth, maybe time to wish the dude well in his future endeavors. At least if he's turning babyface, losing a match like this won't really matter down the road. Later on in the show, Paul Heyman made his grand return. He was out there in a wheelchair. He looked like he was in pretty rough shape. And he cut a promo on Ryback. He basically trashed him. He cut bait with him. He's not a Paul Heyman guy anymore. That's the end of the Heyman-Ryback bromance. And I guess finally Paul Heyman realizes what I've been saying for months about the guy. On SmackDown, Curtis Axel claimed that he too is no longer a Paul Heyman guy. I'm not sure if I missed something here because I don't watch SmackDown all the time, and I thought I saw all the segments on Raw. I don't remember seeing anything or having any indication that there was a rift or something happened between Heyman and Axel. Maybe it did. Maybe they did air something and I missed it, but apparently on SmackDown, he told Ryback, hey, I'm not a Paul Heyman guy either. And the two of them teamed up in the main event against CM Punk and Daniel Bryan, and then later on, after the match, Ryback and Axel got beaten up by the Wyatts. So I don't know what the hell they're doing with these two. I really don't. Splitting them from Heyman would seem to be a bad sign. John Cena was in a handicap match against Antonio Cesaro and Jack Swagger, the Real Americans. Nothing wrong with the match. I thought, as a match, it was actually pretty good. I hate it when they book these matches where John Cena or, whoever the top guy is, and let's be honest, usually it's John Cena, gets to beat two guys, like an established tag team. It looked like they've been kind of pushing the Real Americans of late as more of a threat, And then I don't care if he is the world champion. I don't care if it is John Cena. It's still two against one. And the fact that this guy goes in there and, you know, they're trying to tell the story of his arm and how his arm is still hurt, and he still beats them. You know, he still goes in there and he beats this established team all by himself. I hate it when they do that. I just hate that. So he won, and Del Rio came out to attack Cena when the match was over. He put him in the cross arm breaker. Big E Langston came out to make the save. Langston would face Del Rio later on in a match and would lose another match that not a lot of people seem to care about. The finish of the show, this really was what Raw was all about on Monday night. I thought this show really wasn't that good until the main event. Main event was CM Punk and Daniel Bryan against The Shield. And there was no winner in the match. The match ended when the Wyatt family came out. But once the Wyatts came out, this was awesome. I loved the end of this show. So The Shield gets shoved into the Wyatts. And that leads to a stare down between Rollins and Ambrose and Rowan and Harper, and one thing leads to another, and they end up brawling. And the fans are going nuts. They're chanting, "This is awesome." Punk and Bryan are just outside looking on. Bray Wyatt's on the outside. He starts firing shots away at Roman Reigns. I almost said Luther Reigns. I wonder what Luther Reigns is up to these days. So the people were into this. The people wanted to see these two trios go head-to-head, which is probably a good sign if the idea is to put them up against each other at WrestleMania. I hope they do, and I hope they do in part because I don't want to see The Shield break up yet. I still think The Shield is great. The Shield, I said it before, they and Daniel Bryan, those are your MVPs of Raw in 2013. You take away Bryan, you take away all three members of The Shield, and boy, I know there are some people who aren't really big fans of the WWE product. They think Raw generally sucks. I don't think Raw generally sucks. I think we've had a lot of shitty shows, but we've had a lot of really good shows this year. You take those four guys away, okay, even just The Shield. Take The Shield away? Boy, this is a really, really bad year for Monday Night Raw if you do that. These guys have been the MVPs. They're just so good together. If we can get another 4 or 5 months out of The Shield, you get no argument out of me. So they all turned their attention to Punk and Bryan, who were outnumbered. That's when Cody and Goldust came out. The Usos came out. There was a big brawl. The babyfaces were left standing in the end. This was great. This almost made up for a pretty lackluster show. So if you missed the end of this show, you don't need to see anything else from this show. Watch the last 5 minutes. You could find it. They put it up, WWE did, on their YouTube channel. I hope Triple H and Stephanie stay on permanent vacation, if that means we get more segments like that one. One other piece of WWE news before we move on here. This is hilarious. So originally there was a report posted on PW Insider that WWE updated its wellness policy back in July. And this change kind of flew under the radar for the most part. It's not like they put out any sort of announcement or press release or anything like that. It looks like they just made the change and not too many people even noticed. But of the things that were added, they're pretty big. One of the things they added was a way for a talent to have one of their strikes against them removed should they be in danger of being terminated for receiving a third strike. Because again, by the letter of the policy, if you get three strikes against you, and how you get a strike, I mean, there's multiple ways. Obviously, if you were to fail a wellness test, that's one strike against you. And when you get three, you're gone. I think as per the rules, you're terminated for a year. And after a year, I guess maybe they can bring you back. I think that's how it works. So nobody seems to be 100% sure as far as everything that may have been updated or exactly when it was updated. But there are two things, including the one I just mentioned. But the other thing also is any WWE talent who is arrested, convicted, or who admits to a violation of the law regarding the use, possession, purchase, sale, or distribution of drugs will be in material breach of his or her contract and subject to immediate dismissal. I guess Jack Swagger is one lucky guy. But the other aspect, which I just mentioned, is the big one. A WWE talent who has two violations under the policy may, subject to medical director approval, enter what they call the redemption program. That's what they call it. The redemption program is an 18-month process that requires the following: an initial assessment conducted by the medical director, who will analyze the addiction-related issues and health-related concerns being experienced by the talent, develop proposed treatments, therapies, and or support programs that may assist the talent in managing these issues, and also determine an initial entry date for the talent into the redemption program. There may be no violations under the policy for 18 consecutive months after the initial entry into the program. Upon successful completion of the program, the talent shall request that one of the two violations on record for said talent be removed. And if this is as it appears, meaning that this was implemented in July or at some point earlier on in the summer, it's kind of odd that it was implemented just in time for Randy Orton, Mr. Two Strikes himself, to win the championship again. Orton had not held the WWE title in a few years. And he won it, you know, cashed in Money in the Bank at SummerSlam, won the title. And it just so happens that they now have this redemption program thing where you can have one of your strikes removed if you are in jeopardy of being terminated. It's awfully convenient how that works. I already see some people online referring to this as the Orton principle or the Orton provision. It's awfully hard to argue against it. I just think the timing is very suspect. So that's the new rules implemented in terms of the wellness policy. And Orton is not the only person to have two strikes. You know, Jeff Hardy, who's in TNA still, but Jeff Hardy has two strikes. If he ever comes back to WWE, those two strikes don't go away. He doesn't start from scratch. He still has two strikes. So in the case of Jeff Hardy, I guess he too could enter into this redemption program and try to get one of those strikes removed. And there are a number of other talents who also have two strikes as well, but Orton, I mean, none as prominent as him. After all, he is the face of the company. Let's talk about NXT this week. Run through the results of this show real quick. It was a pretty ho-hum show. Really nothing special about it, but not a bad show. Summer Rae and Sasha Banks beat Bayley and Charlotte after Sasha pinned Bayley. The big turn of events here in this match was Charlotte turning on Bayley. Charlotte, the daughter of the Nature Boy Ric Flair, who's been a babyface ever since she came over to NXT, officially turned heel. Bayley went to make a tag. She was in grave danger, but she fought back, went to make a tag, and instead of tagging, Bayley got smacked right across the face by Charlotte. I didn't see it coming. It actually caught me completely off guard, and she gave Bayley her, I don't even know what the hell she calls it. It's like this flipping diamond cutter move that really doesn't look all that good. Later out, the heels got the win, and then Charlotte went and celebrated with the heels. So apparently the BFFs, which is what they're calling Summer and Sasha, are now a trio. And I guess they joined the ranks of the Shield and the Wyatt family, and 3MB if you want to throw them in there also. I guess WWE sure does love trios these days. So that was the opening of the show. Aiden English beat Camacho. I've had people email me asking me, where have Camacho and Junico been? Well, they're back. They're starting to pop up on TV, and Camacho was on this show here. He took most of this match. He was pretty dominant in this match, and then Aiden English kind of hit his finisher out of nowhere and got the pin. He gave the fans an encore, sang a little bit when the match was over, and they did the deal where the fans or some people crouch down at ringside that we can't see, throw roses at him, which I think is a nice touch. Then we had Mason Ryan. Mason Ryan beat Danny Burch in pretty much a squash match. You know, Mason Ryan is, what was there to say about Mason Ryan? He's still very big. He's not quite as gargantuan as he used to be when he was on TV for a while, many years ago. Still a huge guy, very powerful, very cut, obviously in good shape. And, you know, he's a little bit better. It's not like he's in there botching every move and you know, dropping guys in their heads and stuff like that. The guy, though, you know, he just comes off as having two left feet. Like, there's just not much to him. He's just a big guy. There's no depth. There's no personality. There's no charisma. There's no character. There's nothing. There's just a body. A very cut, physically impressive body, but just a body. You know, he uses the same half Nelson slam finish that Aiden English just used in the previous match, so that was kind of weird to see the same move in back-to-back matches like that. That's a problem, by the way, I think, in WWE, with a lot of finishing maneuvers. A lot of finishers look way too similar. That's a problem. We need more unique finishing moves. But Mason Ryan also does this thing when he comes out, and they must tell him to do this, and he does it to the extreme, where he comes out for his entrance, and he does it all the way to the ring, he does it in the ring, and he does it after the match. He does this hand movement, this hand signal, where it's like, I will break you, like I'm going to break you in half. And he just does it. He does it over and over and over and over again. It's like, do it once or twice, dude, and then quit. Get out while you're ahead. He just does it over and over again. It's like, okay, Mason, listen, we're going to send you out there and just keep doing this. And he does it. It's like he doesn't know how to do anything else. He doesn't know any other way to kind of interact or respond to the crowd. Or he just goes out there, does what he's told, and there's not much more to it than that. I think the best word I could use when it comes to Mason Ryan is he's just far too generic for anybody to care. His physique isn't, but everything else about him screams generic. So I am no more impressed by Mason Ryan now than I was 3 years ago when I saw him on TV. Adrian Neville and Corey Graves had a 2 out of 3 falls match, which hopefully is the culmination of their feud. Both these guys are good. Adrian Neville is great. As a performer in the ring, he's amazing. He's obviously on the small side. He's very small. So I don't know, once they bring him up to the main roster, how far they're willing to go with him. But he can do things in that ring that a lot of other people can't. For whatever reason, these two guys together, whether they were tag teaming or even now that they're feuding, just very boring. I find it very difficult to get into their matches. Neville took the first fall very early on. First 2 minutes of the match, he beat Graves with his Red Arrow corkscrew splash off the top rope. Graves took the second fall with his Lucky 13 leg lock submission. I did like the fact they played up Adrian Neville's knee injury. When Graves turned on him, when they lost the tag titles to the Ascension, they had a rematch, they lost again, and that set Graves off, and Graves attacked Neville, gave him a chop block, went after the knee. That was weeks ago. They've played up the knee injury ever since. So I like the fact that they've at least stayed consistent with that. And the knee injury factored into the match here. He had to tap out. So now we're even, one fall apiece. And a few more minutes go by. It was a pretty long match, too. Probably, 12 or 13 minutes, maybe. And Neville took the third fall, the final fall, with a small package. Graves tried one too many times for his Lucky 13 move. And in doing so, it's kind of like when somebody goes to do the figure four, and there's that one moment where you can just reach up and cradle them. Well, that's what Neville did here. And he got the pin. And like I said, hopefully that is the end of this feud. I don't know where they go with these guys now. I would think, big win like this, that Neville would be in line for a shot at Bo Dallas's NXT title. I guess we'll find out the next set of tapings if that's the direction they go in. And speaking of Bo Dallas is back next week. At long last, our champion returns. He is back from Bolivia, we were told. So, not a great show. I would say it's an acceptable hour of wrestling. The Charlotte turn did catch me off guard, though. But what her motivation is for turning, no idea. I suppose we'll find out next week. Let's move on to TNA here. Talk about Impact. This was the final episode of Impact Wrestling on the road before their big return to Universal Studios in Orlando. There will be more road Impacts in the future at some point. They're not, you know, it's not like they're never going to go back on the road again, but in terms of normal, consistent, every other week road tapings, those days are over. They will be back to their old stomping grounds this week, I believe, is when they're taping a whole bunch of shows. Aces and Eights opened the show with Bully Ray coming out. They were all taking great solace and joy in this ruse that they pulled over all of our eyes. The wool they pulled over Ken Anderson's eyes last week when they teased breaking up, but then they didn't. They were very proud of themselves. So Ken Anderson comes out. And Anderson proposes that, you know, he's wrestling Bully Ray at Turning Point. There's a special Turning Point edition of Impact coming up this Thursday. He proposed that if he beats Bully Ray, Aces and Eights will have to split up. So Bully initially, he refused to agree to that, although that is now the stipulation, one of the stipulations. Anderson said that his wife was pregnant with twins, which is true, and that, you know what, if I can't beat you next week, I will leave TNA forever. And Bully Ray at this point had a great line. I love this line because Bully Ray is an awesome heel. I don't think we have enough good heels like Bully Ray. Bully Ray, after hearing this, that this guy is willing to put his career on the line, even though his wife is back at home, I guess in Green Bay, pregnant with twins. Bully Ray says, you know what? I would love to pile drive your pregnant wife. What an asshole this guy is. But I just thought that was such a great line. heinous thing, obviously, but I thought to myself, boy, that's the sort of thing you would never, ever, ever hear anybody even be allowed to say in WWE. There's a lot of handcuffs that guys have in WWE, especially if you're a heel. Think about it. There's only so much you can do. You can't really push that envelope too far. At least in TNA, they almost don't give a shit. And so Bully can go out there and he can say stupid stuff like that. That he's going to pile drive this pregnant woman, but as a heel, it works. So I actually thought that was a great line. That's like when he was feuding with AJ Styles and he would come out and cut these promos on AJ that were so one-sided because AJ just could not compete. He could not measure up on the mic to Bully Ray. And Bully would just lace into him and he would say, you know what, I'm going to send you back home to your ugly wife and your ugly kids. And I just thought to myself, what a great freaking heel this guy is. This all led to a brawl and a match being made between Mr. Anderson and Nux, which Nux, you know, dominated most of, but Anderson got the win in the end. And when it was over, he took the mic and he did, and this is what I hate about the Mr. Anderson character. Because Mr. Anderson has his moments, and I said this last week, and I can't believe I'm saying it, but when he and Bully have their match on Impact this week, I will be rooting for Mr. Anderson so that we can finally rid ourselves of aces and eights once and for all, okay, and pretend like it never even happened. But when Anderson gets on the mic and he really goes over the top with his little announcer shtick, I can't stand it. It's like nails on a chalkboard. I have to mute the volume on the TV. And that's the Anderson we got here when this match with Nux was over. This is the Mr. Anderson I hate and I loathe and I can't stand. He's just so overwhelmingly and overbearingly obnoxious. That might work well if he was still a heel, but he's not. So there's no reason for him to be this overbearing anymore. I hated this. I hated this part. Ethan Carter III was in a handicap match against the same two jabronis he's been wrestling for about a month now. Norv Furnham and Dewey Barnes. I think the two jobbers are more over with the audience than Ethan Carter is. But Carter got the win. And on commentary, Mike Tenay mentioned that I guess EC3 is now 8-0. Taz disagreed vehemently. Taz insisted that this man now is 9-0 because he beat two guys. It was a handicap match. And Mike Tenay said, no, it counts as one match. He's 8-0. I side with Taz. He beat two guys. He should be 9-0. So we had another one of these Friends of AJ vignettes, paid for by the Friends of AJ. Who these friends are, I have no idea. I don't know who these friends are, but they're paying for all these advertisements on Impact, and they aired footage from Mexico of Styles beating Judas Macias and retaining his TNA title, taking pictures with people at the airport. And they even showed footage of him talking to, I think, was it Joaquin Roldan or Dorian Roldan? One of the president of AAA, whichever one it is. He was having a conversation with him, which was kind of cool to see. And, Dixie Carter, none too happy about this. She's in the production truck or whatever, browbeating and yelling at the producers. And if you paid any attention, you saw Big John Gaborik. Remember Big John from the original Tough Enough in WWE? I think he was in WWE for like 15 years. Well, he's in TNA now, and poor guy was sitting there with his face in his hands, just being lectured by Dixie Carter, probably thinking to himself, what the fuck have I gotten myself into? Why the hell did I ever leave WWE? And to continue the storyline, I should mention AJ Styles successfully defended his TNA championship at yesterday's Wrestle 1 show. He won with the Calf Killer. I don't have the name of the opponent in front of me, but he won. At the same time, apparently there was a 5.5 magnitude earthquake that hit Japan. I don't know if it actually hit literally during the show, but the same day there was an earthquake that hit Japan. Thankfully, nobody was hurt. So they're continuing the storyline. So he's now defended the title in Mexico. He's now defended the title in Japan. Both things I said they should do. I support that idea. I'm happy they did it. It's one of those things that would have made the CM Punk storyline, I think, that much cooler and that much more believable if they would have actually kept him out for a little bit and let him do the things he said in the pipe bomb promo. He mentioned New Japan. He mentioned Ring of Honor. You know, maybe New Japan wouldn't even let it, allow that, but send him to ROH. I'm sure they could work something out where he could have gone and made an appearance there and a few other indies, but they didn't do it. But AJ has now defended the title twice. Now, where he goes from here, I don't know. Unless he goes back to the same promotions, which would make no sense. And I don't think these two promotions want this guy to keep coming back and beating their guys. So either that's the end of it, or they're going to have to start sending him around to some local indies throughout the states. I guess we'll find out where he goes next. Then came a Dixie Carter promo. She came out to the ring. This is not her strong suit. I've talked about this before. Dixie in small doses, there are flashes of positive things since her heel turn where she can be entertaining. I think maybe the most entertaining line I've heard her deliver since this whole thing started 2 months ago was there was a backstage segment where she presented AJ Styles with that check. She was trying to buy him off. This was before Bound for Glory. And she made some comment to the effect of, you know, with the money here that I'm willing to pay you, you could pay, you know, you could buy a new trailer home down there and, you know, help pay for a bunch of little redneck kids to learn how to read. I remember chuckling at that line. Aside from that, it's been 2 months now. Okay, I said that I wanted to give it time. Let's give Dixie Carter, give it at least a few weeks. Don't just judge her based on one or two episodes of Impact. Well, she turned heel in mid-September. So it's now been 2 months, okay, seven, eight, nine episodes of Impact, whatever it's been. And I think I could pretty much say that Dixie Carter is a terrible heel. She is just no good. She's not good. This promo was not good. One great thing here, speaking of lines, she came out, she talked about AJ Styles. She referred to him as that redneck, which probably alienates about 70% of their fan base. And she said this company wasn't about a walk down memory lane. So, like, again, AJ is in the past. Let's not focus on the past. This company's not about walking down memory lane. What a fucking riot that is. This entire company has been a walk down memory lane since day one, at least for the last 6 or 7 years. Kevin Nash, Scott Steiner, Booker T, Hulk Hogan, Ric Flair. Who's this woman kidding? Then we got another great moment and another great example of why Dixie Carter is not a good heel. And why this reminds me more and more with each passing week of the Triple H Stephanie stuff where, you know, they were emasculating all the baby faces for a while, Big Show, Brian, and everybody else, you know. Ziggler and Miz, remember that? They were on stage, they couldn't speak. Everybody just was made to look like complete fools. And it doesn't help get anybody over. She makes this comment, Dixie does, about how last week in the world title tournament, Jeff Hardy beat somebody in the first round. Somebody. That somebody, of course, being a current champion on your roster, the X Division champion, and a man who only a few months ago held your world heavyweight title, Chris Sabin. Somebody, she says. Great job. Dixie called out Bobby Roode, James Storm, Samoa Joe, and Magnus. They are going to have two tournament matches on Impact, the Turning Point edition, this Thursday. Roode and Storm, she announced, after spinning the wheel of Dixie, would be a bull rope match. And Joe and Magnus would have a Falls Count Anywhere match. And so all four guys, they talked. They did some jaw-jacking back and forth. I thought Samoa Joe here was great. Joe was standing up to Dixie and, you know, basically said that you're a bad businesswoman. And he said, you know, after I win the world title, the first person I'm going to defend my championship against is the man who never actually lost the title in the first place. And that man is AJ Styles. See, like a true babyface Joe is. So I thought he did a good job here. And they made two matches, you know, two big tournament matches for Impact this week, which is good. I didn't mind much about the segment except Dixie Carter herself, because Dixie just is not very good. And that really was apparent to me on this show. Gail Kim and Lady Tappa came out. Remember, Kim issued that open challenge to any knockout, any woman outside the company to show up because she had no more competition here anymore. So the person who showed up was Hannah Blossom, one half of the Blossom Twins, who gained some notoriety on their British boot camp reality show that was never spoken of again. Remember Rockstar Spud, right? Came out of that show, big star. He was on Impact once or twice, never heard from again. So here comes Hannah Blossom, which nobody seemed to know who she was. And Kim basically took the entire match. I can't remember if Hannah Blossom had more than maybe one offensive move the whole match. This was just a showcase for Gail Kim, who got the win in the end with her eat defeat move. And I guess the storyline will continue. We'll see if they bring in any actual female talent from outside the company, if they can, you know, afford to pay them. Joseph Park. Joseph Park, earlier in the show, had a match that he requested against Christopher Daniels. The week before, Daniels had thrown an apple teeny in his face, and he was none too happy about this. So he had the match with Daniels. Daniels won with a low blow. And so Park came back out later in the show and talked about how bad influence had really just gotten under his skin, and he was tired of it. And he's also tired of answering questions about the whereabouts of his brother, Abyss. And so he proposed that on Impact this week at Turning Point, it would be him, Joseph Park, one-on-one against his brother, Abyss. So, there you go. I don't know if that's the sign that they're going to blow off this angle finally, or what the plan is exactly. And there are people online, oh my God, what are they going to do? How are they going to pull this off? Remember, early on in the storyline, there was at least one time, I forgot the pay-per-view it was, it might have been a match against Bully Ray. They just had somebody else in the Abyss getup. They put somebody else in the jacket and in the mask. And if I remember correctly, they never shot him in such a way where you could tell it was somebody different. So I think they shot him from behind. So maybe they'll do the same thing again. I don't know. If I remember correctly, it was somebody from the Team 3D training school that he and Devon run that they just put in the Abyss outfit. I, for one, hope that this is some sort of blow-off or whatever the next big step is in this storyline. I love Joe Park to death, I think, as a character. He's great. A little played out at this point, but I still like the character and would prefer him over Abyss. But whatever they're going to do, just do it. This has been going on for far too long now. And I'm looking forward to seeing what they do here. And that's yet another match that they went and announced for Impact this week. That was probably the one thing I have to say that I liked a lot about Impact this week is that they took the time to build up a bunch of big matches. And they really did a good job of making Turning Point this Thursday feel like a special show. You've got the two tournament matches with Rude and Storm and Magnus against Joe. You've got this, whatever the hell this is now, with Park challenging Abyss. And you've got the other match between Anderson and Bully, which will hopefully result in the eradication of Aces and Eights once and for all. And we could put that behind us. So I give them a thumbs up. I thought they did a good job of promoting this week's show. Main event of Impact was a submission match, another match in the TNA title tournament. Kurt Angle against Austin Aries, which may have been their first match ever. I don't recall them wrestling before. And they predictably had what you would expect. They had a really good match. It didn't blow me away or anything. I just thought it was a really well-worked, entertaining professional wrestling match that catered to their strengths. I mean, Aries is not really known as a submission wrestler. He has the Last Chancery. It's not really his finisher. Kurt Angle, obviously, is a submission specialist. It plays to his strengths. So that was part of the story they were telling with this match. About midway through, Bobby Roode came out. He sat down in a chair on stage to watch. They're keeping that storyline going with him and Kurt. And if played into the finish as well, because Kurt beat Aries with the crossface. Couldn't beat him with the ankle lock, but he got him with the crossface in the end, which seemed kind of anticlimactic the way they did that. Aries was getting out of ankle lock attempts and all this stuff, and then he just kind of tapped after, you know, 6 or 7 seconds maybe in the crossface. But I thought it was a really good match. I really dig what they're doing with Kurt and Bobby Roode. A few months ago, I was complaining. I was upset because they weren't doing jack shit with Bobby Roode. And guys like Roode and Aries had kind of fallen to the wayside. And now they're finally, at least with Roode, I don't know what the long-term plan is with Aries, but with Roode, they've got him in a main event level program. And some people are even predicting that he'll win the tournament and he'll get the TNA title back. My first thought when they announced the brackets was that Magnus is going to win, and I stick to that. Wouldn't be shocked if Bobby Roode came out of it with the belt. I certainly wouldn't mind, but I still think Magnus is going to take it. I think they're building him up. He'll be Dixie's face of the future type of thing, and then feud with AJ when he comes back. But for now, I'm really digging the stuff with Roode and Angle, and this was a really good match. And, you know, overall, a good edition of Impact. Not great or anything like that, but definitely there were things that you could pick from it that were very good, including the main event. Really liked the way they built up Turning Point. Looking forward to that show on Thursday. Time for the mailbag. If you have questions you'd like to email to me, please do so at thesolomonster@gmail.com. You could send audio questions to me there as well. MP3 attachments only. Try to keep them brief. And you can put the question in the body of the email as well, or else it probably will not get used. So if you want to send audio questions, that is the way to do it. This first question comes from Aaron. He says, with all the rumors swirling about Hulk Hogan coming back to WWE, how do you think they should bring him back, and who should his last opponent be? I don't think there should be a last opponent for Hulk Hogan, because I don't think he can wrestle. And I don't want to see the guy get hurt. And if he thinks he can wrestle, I don't have any interest in, you know, seeing him creep around the ring slowly and have people just run into his fist. I was going to say run into his boot, but he can't get his leg up that high anymore. I just don't see the appeal in that. He still has a big name, and I think that there's a role for him. I think it would be huge to have Hulk Hogan at WrestleMania. I'm not saying I wouldn't have him there. I would. But in terms of a match, I wouldn't think of it that way. If he comes back, that doesn't mean he's coming back necessarily to have a match. The best kind of match for him to have, honestly, would probably be some sort of tag team match. The problem is, at WrestleMania, you take a guy like John Cena, The Undertaker, Randy Orton, CM Punk, whoever it is, and you put them in a tag team match, it's not as special. Those guys belong in a big singles match of some kind at WrestleMania against a guy who can go. And you put them out there in a singles match and you let them have a great match. I don't envision there being a good tag team match for Hogan at Mania unless they want to do something with Hogan and Cena against, you know, Orton and Triple H in a battle for control of the company or something. I still think it would be disappointing to have Cena relegated to some sort of tag team match. What I would do is this. Here's what I would do with Hulk Hogan. I would bring him in for two things. First, I would bring him in to induct Randy Savage into the Hall of Fame. I would make that announcement that Hulk Hogan will be inducting the Macho Man Randy Savage at long last into the WWE Hall of Fame. Whatever issues they may have had, you know, when Savage died, I don't know what kind of terms, if any, he was on with Hogan. By the end, I don't really know that he hated Hogan's guts the way he used to. But the fact is, in their careers in WWF and WCW, they paralleled each other so much, they worked together so much, the mega powers and everything else. There really is no other person other than maybe the Ultimate Warrior who would make sense to induct Savage. CM Punk, I guess you can make the argument, he's a big Randy Savage mark, right? He even had tights made up with the three stars to look like Savage that he wore a few times. But Warrior you can't do because Warrior's got to go in himself. You're not going to bring the Warrior back to induct somebody else into the Hall of Fame unless he was already in, which he's not. Hogan would make sense. I would have Hogan induct Savage. The other thing I would do with Hogan in bringing him back would not just to induct Savage, obviously. I would make him the host of WrestleMania. They do that sometimes. When they can't figure out a role for somebody, they'll have them host, like The Miz hosted SummerSlam this year, which was a bust. But when The Rock hosted WrestleMania 3 years ago, that WrestleMania did over 1 million buys for a card that wasn't very strong. Without The Rock there, you know, hosting WrestleMania, that show does bad business. I don't think there's any doubt about that. And it was the role that they established for him. So, you know, he didn't take over the show. He had a promo at the beginning of WrestleMania that probably went way too long. I would have cut back on that. But The Rock came out at the beginning, right? Did his big entrance. He said a few words. They did a few backstage segments with him, including a face-to-face with him and Stone Cold that was kind of cool. And then they did whatever that bullshit was at the end of the show with him. And the less we say about the WrestleMania 27 main event, the better. With Hogan, I think it would be the perfect role for him. That way he doesn't have to be in a match because I don't think he can do a match. But you get him on the show. You get him out there. He comes out to Real America and he gets the big ovation from the people. And for all the trash I talked about Hulk Hogan and TNA, and this is to cut off the people before they call me a hypocrite because, you know, that's the first thought they'll have. Oh, you bashed Hulk Hogan so much and now you want to see him at WrestleMania. Yeah, I do. I didn't say I wanted to see Hulk Hogan all over my TV every week like he was in TNA. I'm not saying establish a permanent role for him on television every single week or make him the GM or something like that. But the guy missed WrestleMania 10. The guy missed WrestleMania 20. So I think it would be kind of nice for him to actually be there for WrestleMania 30, get one big, really great ovation from a big crowd, you know, 70,000 people. I like his theme music, personally. I'm a big fan of Real American. I wouldn't mind hearing that song one more time. I got no problem with bringing Hogan back for a one-time big appearance like that, and then you bring him back maybe every now and then for a special appearance. And otherwise, you just use him to promote stuff like the video game and all that. For WrestleMania one time, I got no problem with it. And I think as a host, it allows you to get him out there in front of the crowd and he can, you know, talk about what a big show this is going to be and hype up the main events and then go backstage. And what you can do is you could do an angle with him on the show at some point, either at the beginning, you can trot him back out there maybe midway through if you need like a buffer between two big matches. You could do an angle where Hogan interacts with, I'm just spitting out 3MB. I'm not saying that Hogan should do something with 3MB. 3MB's a bunch of nobodies, but I'm thinking of something along the lines of what he did at WrestleMania 21 back in 05, where he came to Eugene's rescue. He was being beaten up by Hassan and Daivari, so he came out to rescue Eugene. Hassan and Daivari beat him down. He hulked up, did the big comeback, made short work of them, and then he posed. You know, Hogan now is older. He's 8 years older, I guess it is. Not 8 years. Yeah, he's 8 years older now than he was then. He's had a lot of back surgeries. When the guy did that Australia tour with Ric Flair before he came into TNA, they did that tour. He wrestled him. He wasn't doing much. His hip came out. His hip actually popped out. So, you know, what can you really do physically with Hogan? Even a beatdown like that, I don't know that Hogan could take something like that. But surely he can do some sort of angle, at least, where he, you know, beats up 3MB. Nobody's going to give a shit if Heath Slater sells for some weak-looking punches from Hulk Hogan. But you allow him to get physical, at least, that way. And again, he poses. People cheer. Maybe he rips off his shirt, maybe not. And he moves on. And then you go on with the rest of the show. That's the role that I envision for Hulk Hogan at WrestleMania. I'd like to see him, induct Savage into the Hall of Fame. He can host the show. He can do an angle like he did at WrestleMania 21 and beat up a couple of jabronis and pose for the fans and get the nice big send-off, and that's it. That's the role I envision for Hulk Hogan at WrestleMania. Raimi from Morocco, I just want to start off by saying that the anniversary show is awesome. How much of a draw was Shawn Michaels in the 90s during his title reigns? And if he wasn't, why do you think that is? When WWE did the angle in early 96, when he came back from... You know, remember they said he had post-concussion syndrome from the Syracuse attack? He got the shit kicked out of him. He didn't actually have a concussion, so that whole thing was made up. But they brought him back, and they were hyping up his comeback at the Royal Rumble. And it did have a positive effect on business. I remember reading about that and reading about, you know, like in terms of the business that they were doing at that time, there was an uptick. So that worked. After he won the championship, there's no real evidence that he was any great draw on top as the champion. I looked up the numbers as far as pay-per-view buy rates and ticket sales. That sort of thing. 1996 really was not much of a great year for WWE. They did do 60,000 people in the Alamo Dome in San Antonio for the Royal Rumble in 97, which was in Shawn's hometown. And he challenged Sid to win back the championship. That was kind of the big thing going into the Rumble that year. So they did 60,000 people in that building, but that's very misleading. Because that Rumble show was severely papered, very heavily papered. So there were a lot of freebies to get people in the building. They lowered ticket prices as a way to get more people into the building, as many as they possibly could. And they still couldn't fill it up, but they've somehow managed to get 60,000 people in there. But it would be misleading to say, oh, well, Shawn was the reason for that. Well, no, because a good part of that 60,000 probably didn't even give a shit about Shawn Michaels. They just wanted to get free tickets so they can get in the building. Or maybe they got their tickets for 10 or 20 bucks. That has nothing to do with Shawn Michaels' drawing ability in his hometown at that time. So I think there may be two reasons for this. For one thing, the NWO angle started not long after Shawn's first reign began, okay, mid-96. Then Hogan did the turn in July. And from there, it was off to the races. The NWO angle at that time was the cool thing. People got into it. And it wasn't long before WCW became really popular and they started kicking WWF's ass. It was going to be hard, I think, for anybody to compete with. It's a little unfair to Shawn because I think anybody in that position would have been hurt by what WCW was doing. It was the cool thing. It was hard not to get intrigued and excited and interested in the NWO stuff at the very beginning. After a while, it got watered down, but in the beginning, all of my friends, even the ones who weren't WCW fans, they were totally into the NWO stuff. So that worked against him. But here's the other thing. I think you have to look at the kind of babyface that Shawn Michaels was. Okay, just look at the guy. The guy pranced around in chaps and long earrings. He wasn't exactly perceived as a tough guy. As a top babyface in the company, I don't think that works. I think there's still that mentality that a guy on top babyface who's going to draw and really be an attraction has got to be big. He's got to look tough. He's got to be all jacked up or whatever the case may be. You know, Austin, for his era, it worked. He was anti-authority. Austin was never this big jacked up monster the way Hulk Hogan was in the 80s. That worked for Hogan, though. Nobody will ever say that Shawn Michaels wasn't charismatic. He wasn't good on the mic. He wasn't a good wrestler. He had all those things. But he wasn't this intimidating presence. If anything, he was the opposite, because he would come out, he would dance around, and he would, you know, all these things that I don't really know a lot of young males who necessarily were into that sort of thing. I know he had his fans. I'm not saying he didn't, but you got to look at the kind of babyface he was. He wasn't walking around like a big, tough guy. So I think all of those things worked against him, and that's probably why he never really took off as this big box office babyface. Manj sends this in. I just read a rumor of Ryback turning babyface again and his opponent being Brock Lesnar. I hope the match is a casket match, seeing as how, in your words, Ryback is dead anyway. Yes, Ryback wrestles Brock Lesnar at the Royal Rumble. If that match happens, I think it should be a casket match. That way, when Ryback loses, they can lay him to rest once and for all. You know, the more I think about it, Ryback is the kind of wrestler who would have benefited from wearing a mask, I think, that covers up his entire face, like Kane back in the day with his original mask. If he wore a cool-looking mask and just ripped through people, I think he could have been huge. People sure as shit wouldn't be chanting Goldberg at him every single night. You know, even when he was a babyface, they were chanting Goldberg at him. We don't have any masked monsters anymore. Rowan has that sheet mask, but it's pretty freaky, but it's not really what I mean. You know, he wears it, but it you know, he takes it off. Like, everybody knows what he looks like. I mean somebody who really wears all the time, full time, this cool looking mask and just rips through people. I think Ryback could have been that guy. It's too late now. You can't put a mask on him now. Everybody knows what he looks like, but I think, hindsight being 20/20, I think that might have worked for him. Mike says, I recently rewatched Triple H vs. The Rock at Fully Loaded 1998 in a 2 out of 3 falls match for the Intercontinental title. Even though it was filled with interference from DX and The Nation, I still found it to be very entertaining. So I was wondering if you think it would be cool to see Rock and Triple H have one more big match at WrestleMania. Maybe the People's Champ shows up to save the fans from the Authority. It just seemed like Rock and Triple H had good chemistry in that match, and I thought it would be cool to see them go at it again. I've said it on this show before. If Rock comes back for another match and they need an opponent for Triple H, I wouldn't mind seeing the two of them have a match again at all. I enjoyed their rivalry. I think Rock vs. Triple H is one of the company's great all-time feuds. Not the best, but it's up there. The Fully Loaded match, their ladder match at SummerSlam the month after, their Backlash match in 2000, the Iron Man match 1 month after that. They never did get to have that one big singles match at WrestleMania. They had that Fatal 4-Way at WrestleMania 2000 with Big Show and Foley. If they want to bring Rock back as a surrogate maybe for Vince McMahon to take out Triple H and the Authority, you know, I would prefer that role go to somebody like Daniel Bryan or CM Punk, somebody current, especially Bryan after the way he's been shit on by the Triple H character on TV. He should get his revenge at some point. But I would be cool with one more Rock Triple H match, absolutely. Brian writes in, I was thinking about the Hall of Fame, and one name that always sticks to mind is Bam Bam Bigelow. Does he make the cut in your view? Because I always considered that guy not only one of the greatest wrestlers to never win the big one, but top 5 super heavyweights of all time, right up there with Big Show, Andre, and Yokozuna. Well, don't forget Vader. Vader may be the best super heavyweight in history, in my opinion. Anyway, he says, Bigelow's style was revolutionary for guys his size, and I don't think there's been anyone quite like him since. What do you think? I always loved it when Bigelow would bust out one of those cartwheels early on in his career. He didn't really do it later on, but yeah, at the beginning he did. If he came along now, they'd probably tell him to stop doing that, like they did to Damian Sandow. I definitely think Bam Bam Bigelow is worthy of Hall of Fame consideration. He was a great big man wrestler. I mean, as a wrestler, period, he was very good, but he was a great big guy wrestler, very innovative for his time and agile. He had a very unique look that made him one of the more identifiable names outside of wrestling back in the day. I mean, people see the Fu Manchu and the bandana. They know that means Hulk Hogan. You see the tattooed flaming head. You don't see too many of those. At least back then you didn't. So he was very easy to distinguish who he was. He headlined a WrestleMania, which not too many people get to do. But then again, so did The Miz. So, God, I guess I just made a good case for Miz to go into the Hall of Fame also one day. Hey, you know what? Look, as much as I don't care much for The Miz right now, it's well documented on this show, you can make the case that based on his credentials, he should go in one day. And I would accept that because the guy has accomplished a lot in his career. He really has. And his career, he's still got many more years probably left to go. The Miz is a young guy. He's in his early 30s, I think. Can't believe I'm saying that, but all of that is true. So yes, I inadvertently just made a case for The Miz to go into the Hall of Fame one day. Anyway, Bam Bam, yes, he is Hall of Fame worthy. The guy once saved three kids from a burning building, and he suffered burns all over his body because of it. You find me another guy that's already in the Hall of Fame who can say they did something as selfless as what Bam Bam Bigelow did? You can't. I'd put him in there for that alone. This next email comes from Matt. Is it true that Sid Vicious and Arn Anderson got into a huge fight one night back in WCW in the early 90s? According to rumors, the fight took place on the road late one night and resulted in Sid stabbing Arn multiple times with a pair of scissors. The article I read also states this altercation led to Sid jumping ship to WWF. Is this a true story? Do you know what caused the fight? Were both men arrested? And considering that Sid went back to WCW in the late 90s, did he and Arn make peace after this? Yes, this is one of the more wild and crazy stories from back in the day. It did happen. It is true. You only wish they had cell phone cameras back then to catch it all on video. It was in 1993. The guys were on a tour. I've seen so many shoot interviews from people. Like they've had interviews from Too Cold Scorpio, the Nasty Boys, Vader. Like all these guys were on tour at the time. I want to say it was in the UK. It was somewhere in Europe. They had just flown like 8 or 9 hours to get there, and then they had like another 5 hours to travel by bus. Then they had to wrestle. Then they had to get back on the bus and travel again. So just crazy what they put these guys through. I'm sure they were all pretty wound up by that point. So Sid and Arn were at the bar with some other wrestlers. They were talking about what was wrong with WCW at the time. You know, why aren't they drawing as well as they should be or something to that effect. And Sid made a comment. Whether he was drunk or not, I don't know. But Sid made a comment that the reason is because of old guys like Ric Flair not stepping aside and making room for the newer guys. And so that led to a war of words between him and Arn Anderson. Supposedly Arn threw a beer in Sid's face. I think Doug Dillinger, who was the head of security for WCW, may have been there. He broke it up. So now the guys are going to go back to their hotel room. They're all really tired anyway. So they go off, and Sid claims, because Sid has also done interviews giving his side of the story, and you know, Sid claims that Anderson had threatened him. He had like a beer bottle, maybe he broke the beer bottle, and he had made threats towards him. So Sid went back to his room, and the only thing he saw, the only thing he could find, was a chair. So he ripped the leg off the chair. So he went to go find Arn Anderson, who I guess was back in his room at this point, and Sid's banging on his door, waiting for Arn to come out. And when Arn Anderson opens the door, he has a pair of scissors. So by all accounts, it was Arn Anderson most likely who introduced the scissors into this fight. So it's not as though Sid is, you know, this guy who's a big goof who made a bunch of comments and had a big chip on his shoulder. It's all Sid's fault. Fault goes both ways in this fight if you listen to people's accounts of the story. Neither man was innocent. And it sounds like Arn was the one to bring scissors into the situation. As a matter of fact, Sid got stabbed in the stomach with a pair of scissors. Vader even said that he was in his own room and basically didn't see any of the actual initial fight happen. But when he came out, he saw Sid coming and saw blood pouring out of Sid's stomach. And he actually had to put his thumb into the wound to help stop the bleeding until, I guess, the paramedics came. So Sid got stabbed. Sid and he wrestled down to the ground. He somehow got the scissors out of Arn's hand and proceeded to start stabbing at Arn multiple times, all over the face, all over the body. He's stabbing Arn Anderson. Too Cold Scorpio comes out of his room. He sees this happening. Hardly anybody else came out to stop this fight or to help these guys. Too Cold was like the only guy, and I remember in his interview, he was kind of, you know, annoyed by this. Because I think Flair may have actually been on the tour. He may have been in one of the rooms, but he was the guy who had to come out. He was the guy, or one of the guys, who had to end up going to the police station, I think, to give statements. This big bloody brawl, and Sid is just stabbing away at Arn. And then he looks down, he finally realizes what the hell he's done, and goes and walks away. And the police obviously were called. Neither guy was actually arrested. Sid claims that the police came to him and they asked him if he wanted to press charges. Sid didn't want to press charges. It's like a wrestler code, I guess. You don't do something like that. Sid claims the police actually told him that Anderson didn't have a scratch on him. Arn was actually in great shape. Meanwhile, here's Sid, who had to undergo surgery to help repair the wound in his stomach. And Sid claims he got all pissed off. He was all ready to press charges after all. And then one of the nurses later on came to him and said, boy, you know, your friend, he's in really rough shape. So Sid realized at that point the cops had lied to him. So there were no charges that were actually filed. And I think part of it also was both guys were flying back to the U.S. anyway. So they just never, the police never really pursued anything. What ended up happening from this, the fallout, Sid was supposed to wrestle Vader at Starrcade that year and win the WCW title, not Ric Flair. But Sid ended up getting released because of what happened. Anderson kept his job. I don't know, what trouble he may have gotten into, but Arn stayed. Sid got fired. He did not jump back to WWF right away, so that part of the story you read isn't exactly accurate. He got released. It would have been late 93. Sid didn't end up back in WWF until early 95. That was when they brought him back as Shawn Michaels' bodyguard before WrestleMania 11. So that's when he came back. But talk about changing history. That Ric Flair Vader match at Starrcade is one of the all-time great WCW matches and one of the all-time great matches in Flair's career. It was this great big comeback story. Flair had come back to the company earlier that year. He had the Flair for the Gold talk segment, but he couldn't wrestle because of the agreement leaving WWF. He couldn't wrestle for a while. So eventually he was finally able to wrestle, and they built ended up doing Flair and Vader instead, and that turned out to be a fantastic match, and it was a big win for Flair. He got the belt back and everything. Sid really screwed himself there. Sid could have been WCW champion. They were going to build everything around him. He had a good look. He was a big guy, but he ran his mouth, and it got him in trouble. And Arn Anderson certainly is, it sounds as though he's every bit as culpable in this as Sid is. I mean, maybe Sid was saying some stupid shit, but once the scissors got brought in, I mean, now you're dealing with a deadly weapon, and that's, you just don't do something like that. But, yeah, Arn Anderson had stab wounds all over his body. Sid had a stab wound in his stomach, at least, and it was a dicey situation. Sid lost a lot of blood. Arn Anderson lost a lot of blood as well and had a lot of stitches. Either one of those guys could have been killed. But I would advise you to go. I'm sure on YouTube you can find clips from some of these interviews and just listen to the different stories. It's just, to me, it's one of the more wild, crazy, true stories in wrestling history that you read about it. I had somebody write into me recently asking me that question. What's the most wild and crazy true story you've ever heard? And the plane ride from hell in WWF in 2002, that may take the cake. That's way up there with this one, but this one is one of the more wild ones. And they did make peace many years later. Sid came back to WCW. They put the past behind them, and they were able to coexist and work together. So all is well, I think, now between them. I saw the Four Horsemen DVD that WWF put out a while ago, and I believe Arn did talk about it on there. I can't remember what he said. I don't think he said anything disparaging about Sid. You can listen to the different interviews yourself and just get the different perspectives on what happened. It certainly sounds like neither man was innocent in this. Kale writes in, why do you think Billy Gunn never received a main event push? He had the look and even won King of the Ring. He wasn't the best in the ring or on the mic, but a lot of guys have those same problems and still get pushed. I think it's because the Attitude Era was loaded with talent and he just got lost in the shuffle. I think that's part of it, and I think part of it also is Billy Gunn just wasn't a main event guy. Some guys just are not main event guys. I've said that before about Zack Ryder. Sometimes people take their love for a guy a little too far and you come to the realization that you can only go so far because you're just not at that level. And I never looked at Billy Gunn as being quite on that level. And you're right. At the same time, he came along at a time they were trying to push him. You had Austin on top, Rock on top, Triple H, Undertaker, Kane, Big Show. There's only so much room So I think those are the two main reasons. His second question, what was the point of DX when Triple H took over? Was it just to get him to the main event? Because everybody else in the group virtually did nothing afterwards. I don't know that was the whole purpose behind DX, was just to get Triple H over as a main event guy. I think they just liked DX. DX was over with the crowd. Michaels was going to go away. They didn't want to kill the group off. So Triple H became the de facto leader. And they did a lot of crazy fun stuff, you know, from the tank, trying to invade the WCW show, to all the other juvenile BS they did, pissing on DOA's motorcycles and everything else. I don't really think the whole purpose was just to get Triple H over as a main event guy. X-Pac went on, he held a couple of tag team titles, and the Outlaws held tag team titles. Triple H held the Intercontinental title. And eventually the group was just going to break up, and they moved Triple H into more of a main event position. But I think they just didn't want DX to end when Sean left. DX was like their version of the NWO in that it was their really popular faction that people just loved, and so they can sell DX merchandise and make a lot of money off that. I think that was really the reason for it. This question comes to us from Sachin. My question concerns SmackDown ratings. This week's show did 2.9 million viewers, which is pretty impressive, but if you were in Vince McMahon's shoes, what would you do with SmackDown to get at least 3 million viewers every week throughout the year? Simple. I'd get rid of Raw. I wouldn't want to, but you're asking me, how can you get SmackDown numbers up to that level? That's the only way. Get rid of Raw. That's the only way you're ever going to get that many viewers to tune into SmackDown every single week. If it's the only show that's left, you got your 3 million viewers. That's the only way. Reese writes in, what are your thoughts on the rumored match between Brock Lesnar and Ryback? And also, do you think Shane McMahon will make an appearance at WrestleMania 30? The Shane McMahon thing, that comes from an item that I think was in this week's Figure 4 newsletter. It was like almost like a throwaway item in there about there being some murmurs that WWE might want Shane, and more so the Triple H Stephanie camp. Like, they would want Shane there, which is kind of surprising to me. Maybe it shouldn't be, but if they're going to cap off whatever this big McMahon angle is at WrestleMania, then why not? Why not bring in Shane for an appearance? As long as he's not going to pop up on TV every week, I got no problem with that. I like Shane. The first question, Brock and Ryback, that's the other big rumor. I think I kind of mentioned it earlier. I don't know how accurate that is. That supposedly is the working plan, is to bring Brock back early so he'll wrestle at the Rumble and WrestleMania. Look, if they've got enough matches with Brock on, you know, in his contract where they can use it on the Rumble, then I say fine. Anytime you can get Brock Lesnar on pay-per-view is probably a good thing. Is it a waste, though? Are you wasting a Brock Lesnar match by putting him in the ring with a guy that they have booked like shit for months? That's the question that people should ask. Is it a waste of Brock Lesnar to put him in there with Ryback? Or is it an easy win for Brock? He would have to win, because whatever they're going to do with him at WrestleMania, if you're going to build Brock for a match with Undertaker, if you're going to build him up for a match with The Rock, those are big matches. You don't want Brock Lesnar to lose, and then 2 months later, you're going to try to build him up as something special. So for Ryback, I think it would be great, just because any big profile match like that Ryback could have is good for him. Because otherwise, he's stuck losing to R-Truth on television. If they turn him babyface, and now he turns his spear, so to speak, on Paul Heyman to get revenge for Heyman cutting him and saying horrible things about him. Yeah, I guess it would make sense to have Heyman bring back Brock to take out Ryback and shut him up. And it would be a big match for them to promote for the Rumble. For Ryback, it makes total sense. Just like a match with Goldberg at WrestleMania. Even if he loses, it's a big match for Ryback. What else does the guy have at this point? He should be begging for these matches, win or lose. So for him, it's great. For Brock, I don't really know what Brock gets out of it. I suppose it would be an attraction, but how much of an attraction? They're two big guys, so what? Ryback just lost to R-Truth. Is he really that much of a threat to Brock Lesnar? This is where it kind of comes back, I think, to bite them on the ass, the way they've booked this guy. At least if you could take him somewhat seriously, I'd say, you know what? Hey, Brock and Ryback, that could be a pretty good match. Now, the way he's been booked, I can't really say I'm all that excited about it. But I guess if you can get Brock on the Rumble, then go for it. Finally, Dylan in Louisiana has not a question this week, but a comment. He says, while talking wrestling with a friend, we got on the subject of Brock Lesnar, Chris Jericho, and now RVD. returning for limited runs when I suddenly realized they had become the McRibs of WWE. Catch them while you can because they're only around for a limited time. The McRibs, that is pretty funny. The only difference is none of those three guys will clog your arteries and cause you to drop dead. This week in wrestling history, we got a lot of Survivor Series notes this week. It's that time of year, so as you might imagine, a lot of Survivor Series events happened this week in history. We'll get to that in a second. First, 30 years ago this week, on November 15, 1983, the team of Mr. USA, Tony Atlas and Soul Man Rocky Johnson, beat Afa and Sika, the Wild Samoans, to win the WWF Tag Team Championship in Allentown, Pennsylvania, becoming the first African-American team to hold the titles. They called themselves the Soul Patrol. And I say that out loud, and I can't not think of these guys back in the day with Soul Glow hair. Just let your soul glow. Just let it shine through. Just let your soul glow, baby. Feeling oh so silky smooth. Just let it shine. Coming to America is a great movie for those who don't get that reference. Watch it. You'll enjoy it. 26 years ago this week, on November 16, 1987, WWF held a rare Legends Battle Royal at a live event in New Jersey at the Meadowlands, featuring tons of guys who rarely, if ever, wrestled for WWF and really made names for themselves outside the company. So they had guys like Lou Fez, Nick Bockwinkel, Eduardo Carpentier, Pat O'Connor, The Crusher, Killer Kowalski, and others. Lou Fez, who was 72 years old at the time, won the match. This is the Battle Royal that Keith Elliott Greenberg referred to in that great, great piece he wrote for Bleacher Report earlier this year on the final days of the Macho Man Randy Savage. He interviewed Lanny Poffo for the piece, and Lanny said that Randy really loved Vince McMahon up until that Battle Royal because his father, Angelo, was not invited to participate. And, Lanny said that Randy felt awful at the event when Al Costello, who is in the match, and he was one of Angelo Poffo's best friends in the business, went up to Randy and said, "Hey, where's your dad? He should be here." And Savage apparently held a grudge against Vince for it right up until the day he died. He still brought that Battle Royal up in conversations with Lanny until the bitter end. He felt guilty that he did not do more to lobby, I guess, for his dad to be in that match. And I can believe it. I mean, the way Savage lobbied hard for his dad to be inducted into the WCW Hall of Fame when they had one, I believe Lanny when he says that it was Randy's wish for the whole family to go into the Hall of Fame if they ever came calling. There were a lot of telltale signs that Randy really had that. He was so close to his dad, and he believed so much in respecting that legacy that he had that I know some people won't believe Lanny and they'll think he's just saying that to get himself into the Hall of Fame. I don't feel that way. I actually believe him when he says that. And he seems to have really had a soft spot for his father. And he would have wanted him to get that respect, I guess, that he feels Vince McMahon didn't give him going all the way back to that Battle Royal. See, it just goes to show you, don't hold grudges. It's not healthy. 24 years ago this week, on November 15, 1989, the NWA held its Clash of the Champions show on TBS titled New York Knockout, which capped off the legendary feud between Ric Flair and Terry Funk. 1989 was quite the awesome year for Ric Flair. Between this feud that he had with Terry Funk and those classic matches with Ricky Steamboat, on this show, he defeated Funk in an I Quit match with the Figure Four Leg Lock, one of Flair's greatest matches, which you can find on the Ultimate Ric Flair Collection DVD that WWE put out many years ago. One of my favorite releases they ever produced. And why wouldn't it be? It's got the full Royal Rumble match from 1992 on there. I'm a huge mark for that match. 22 years ago this week, on November 11, 1991, the Million Dollar Man, Ted DiBiase, who had lost his precious Million Dollar belt to Virgil in a match at SummerSlam that year, he won the belt back at a live event in Utica, New York. Virgil is still to this day the only man to ever beat DiBiase for the championship. 18 years ago this week, on November 13, 1995, at a joint WCW New Japan show in Tokyo, Japan, Kensuke Sasaki beat Sting to win the WCW United States Championship, the first time in history the U.S. title ever changed hands outside the United States. WCW and New Japan had a working agreement together at the time, and in fact, the theme for that year's Starrcade pay-per-view the month after was the World Cup of Wrestling, and it featured a whole bunch of interpromotional matches with WCW talent and New Japan talent. Sting won the World Cup for WCW, getting his win back over Sasaki in the process, although it was not for the title. When the pay-per-view was over, they held a dark match pitting Sasaki against the one-man gang for the U.S. title. And I guess in order to get the title off Sasaki but allow him and New Japan to save face, they had one-man gang give him a splash, and the referee counted three, even though Sasaki kicked out. Clearly, he kicked out. They restarted the match, and Sasaki ended up getting the win, but what they actually aired on WCW Saturday night was footage of Gang winning the title and holding up the belt before quickly cutting away. So they never actually showed Sasaki's win after the match restarted, so he never technically lost the U.S. title. It's a little trivia note for you. 17 years ago this week, on November 17, 1996, first ever Survivor Series at Madison Square Garden. It featured the debut of some guy named Rocky Maivia, who was the sole survivor for his team, pinning Goldust to get the win. Bret the Hitman Hart made his return to the ring on pay-per-view for the first time since his Iron Man match with Shawn Michaels at WrestleMania that year. He beat Stone Cold Steve Austin in their very first meeting. It's a match that gets overlooked a lot because of their I Quit match at WrestleMania 13, which is awesome. I know some people actually like this match better. I still like their WrestleMania match more, but this was really good stuff. Bret won with the same finish he used to beat Roddy Piper at WrestleMania 8. Where, you know, the guy's got him in a sleeper hold, he kicks off the ropes while he's trapped in the sleeper hold, falls back onto the opponent, so Austin's shoulders got pinned to the mat. And in the main event, this is one of my favorite Survivor Series matches ever. Psycho Sid pinned Shawn Michaels to win the WWF Championship for the very first time, ending Shawn's first run with the title. The atmosphere for this match, it was totally made by the fans. The fans absolutely turned on Shawn Michaels in the building this night. He was still the big babyface champion going into the show. The people in New York, I would say it was at least a 70-30 split, maybe more, in favor of Sid over Shawn. And Sid wasn't the heel going into the match, per se. Sid, here's the backstory on Sid. We had a lot of Sid on the Sound Off this week. Sid came back that summer as a last-minute replacement for the Ultimate Warrior. The Ultimate Warrior had come back to WWF. You knew that wasn't going to last, and it didn't. Shit happened. He got fired. Well, he got fired after they were already promoting a match for the pay-per-view in July. It was a six-man tag. It was going to be Shawn, Ahmed Johnson, and the Warrior against Vader, Bulldog, and Owen. Okay, Camp Cornette. So Warrior's gone. They need a replacement. They worked out a deal to bring back Sid. So that's when Sid came back to the company, and he came back as a babyface. Well, as the months went on, the reactions to Sid got louder and louder. Sid was getting superstar babyface reactions from the fans, and it all culminated at this pay-per-view when he came out in New York City and the crowd went crazy for him. People loved Sid. I still remember him walking down the aisle. He'd look at like the fans in the front row and just, you know, shout at them, you know, "Who's the man?" And they would say, "You are, you are." And Shawn came out, and it was the polar opposite. People were booing him. They just did not like the pretty boy babyface champion, you know, dancing down to the ring. So they had, you know, they had a good match. I wouldn't call it a great match or anything like that, but the atmosphere was great. The match itself was good enough. The finish is where Sid took an evil turn. And he took an evil turn because Shawn in his corner had his legendary mentor, Jose Lothario, who at the time looked to be certainly nothing short of 90 years old, even though I think he was probably 60-something. He looked old. And so Sid, with the referee down, grabs a television camera right out of the cameraman's hands, and he's about to hit Shawn Michaels with it. Jose Lothario now is on the apron, and instead, Sid turns and hits Lothario right in the chest with the TV camera. Which apparently, and I didn't know this, I read this somewhere, that there was an ECW pay-per-view the month before, or the night before, or something like that, where they did a similar finish where somebody got hit with a camera. I don't know if that's accurate. Maybe some ECW fans out there can fill me in because I wasn't watching a lot of ECW back then. Regardless, that was the finish they went with. And Sean super kicks Sid, but then he sees Jose's down. Now, when you see an old guy laying on the ground clutching his chest, you got to take that seriously. And Sean goes out there. He's all concerned. Sid ends up coming back outside, has the camera, hits Sean in the back with the camera, inexplicably starts shouting, "Fuck you," at Sean, which, if you listen closely, you can hear him say it twice, in fact, Sid said it. He throws Sean back in the ring, gives him the powerbomb, gets the pin. When he pins him, the place goes nuts. Big pop for Sid winning the championship, even though he just, he may have killed this old man at ringside, okay? Paramedics come out, they're working on Jose. People don't seem to know if he's going to live or die, if he's having a heart attack or what's happening. But boy, these people were happy. They were happy to see Psycho Sid win that championship. My only regret was, you know, I was younger and I didn't really go to as many shows then as I do now when they come to the area. I wish I was in the building that night when that match happened. It's one of those times I think it would have been really an experience to be there for the match. Why the people turned so rabidly on Sean, I don't know. It could have just been, you know, it's New York and it's just one of those things. But to me, that's one of the more memorable main events in the history of Survivor Series. 11 years ago came our second Madison Square Garden Survivor Series, this one in 2002, which featured three big events. There were three big happenings on this show. First was Paul Heyman turning on Brock Lesnar and aligning with Big Show, helping Big Show win the WWE Championship, and hand Lesnar his first loss in the process. Brock was undefeated. He had his own little streak going. And they decided to let Big Show beat him. I thought it was a mistake then. I still think it's a mistake. Brock gave an F5 to Big Show during the match, which was one for the highlight reel. I think we're almost desensitized now to seeing John Cena and his absurd strength pick people up on his shoulders for the AA and all that stuff. But back then, when Brock picked up Big Show for this F5, people stood up. Their mouths were agape. They couldn't believe what they were seeing. It was a highlight reel moment. That would have been a really great moment after he dumped him. To just have the match end. People were going crazy. They're jumping up and down. They're cheering for Brock, who was a heel coming into this match. I mean, you had already started to see a bit of a turn. He was having some verbal spats with Paul Heyman more often. You know, Heyman tried to control the monster, and he couldn't. Brock wanted to do his own thing. But Brock was, I mean, more or less, he was still a heel. But this was the match where he officially turned, and people realized it. And the second big moment on this show was the debut of Big Papa Pump, Scott Steiner. He came out to interrupt the love fest in the ring between Chris Nowinski and Matt Hardy, who were insulting the New York fans. He beat both of them up, and on Steiner's first night in the company, he could be clearly heard telling the ring announcer to, quote, "Give me the fucking mic," end quote. This was the best Steiner looked his entire WWE run, just going in there, beating guys up, throwing them out of the ring. He came off like a big deal here until he started wrestling, and then it was all downhill from there. And finally, the main event was the first ever Elimination Chamber match, which featured Rob Van Dam crushing Triple H's throat with a frog splash off the top of one of those pods, and Shawn Michaels, in only his second match since coming back after a 4-year layoff, pinning his buddy Triple H to win the World Heavyweight title. Both Big Show and Shawn Michaels, who won championships on this show, would lose those titles at the following pay-per-view. 15 years ago this week, November 15, 1998, WWE's Survivor Series pay-per-view in St. Louis. This was the Deadly Game Tournament, when the championship was, as they would say these days, in abeyance. Back then, you just said the fucking thing was vacant. And they had a big tournament. It was a one night only. I think, was it a 14-man tournament or something like that? It was a big tournament. And when you have a huge tournament like that and you do it all in one night, I like the Deadly Game Tournament. I look back on it now and I think it was a cool thing for them to do. But I went back and I watched some of it. And the thing is, it's not all great because what you end up with are just a bunch of short 3, 4, maybe 5-minute matches and some, you know, bullshit finishes and... you know, it wasn't all good stuff. It had its moments. I think I just like the idea of them doing a one-night-only tournament for the vacant title. Some of the occurrences on the show, Dwayne Gill who would later go on to great success as Gilbert. Dwayne Gill was brought in as Mankind's surprise first-round opponent, so you can imagine how disappointed the fans were to find out that he was the big surprise. That was also the show where Mick Foley got his first pinfall win. I think it was his first pinfall win ever, over Steve Austin. And he would get another one at SummerSlam the following year in that triple threat with Triple H and Jesse Ventura as the ref. This event was all about crowning a new corporate champion, that being The Rock. The Rock was neck and neck with Stone Cold as top babyface in the company heading into the show. One big babyface was enough, I guess, and they had Rock turn after the main event. They did a rehash of the Montreal Screwjob from the year before as a nice little fuck you to Bret Hart. And Rock beat Mankind with the sharpshooter, even though Mankind never tapped out. And The Rock became the new WWF champion, winning his very first title. And embraced Vince and Shane McMahon when the match was over. Steve Austin came out. He ended up beating up The Rock and throwing him out of the ring. So that was a tip-off to what would be that year's WrestleMania main event. One year later, on November 14th, WWE Survivor Series at the Joe in Detroit, Kurt Angle made his in-ring debut against Sean Stasiak, Meat, as he was known at the time. Angle grabbed the microphone in the middle of the match to chastise the fans for booing an Olympic hero. Kurt was awesome from his very first match. It's amazing how quickly he picked things up and progressed, and less than a year later, he would be the WWE champion. Main event was scheduled to be a triple threat match involving Stone Cold Steve Austin, The Rock, and Triple H for the WWE title, and what I believe would have been the very first time on TV those three guys would have been in a match like that together, but it never happened. WWE pulled a bait and switch on its fans during the show where they ran an angle showing Steve Austin getting run down by a car backstage. And Big Show, who had already wrestled earlier in the show, was selected as his replacement and ended up winning the title thanks to an assist from Vince McMahon. Oh, God, I hope they don't recycle the same finish next Sunday. They knew Austin's neck was hurt going into that pay-per-view, and that he wouldn't be able to wrestle. They knew this. I don't know how far in advance they knew, if we're talking days, if we're talking a week, 2 weeks, but they knew. It was at least several days. And they chose not to tell people until after they already bought the show. So, a real scumbag move on WWE's part. You want to do an angle like that, do it on the go-home show, and then hype a mystery person taking Austin's place at the pay-per-view. I think people still would have been disappointed when they found out it was the Big Show, but at least you're being upfront about it with your own fans. They must have been so panicked at the idea that, you know, their meal ticket, Steve Austin, wouldn't be on this show. They just wanted to do everything they could to get him on that show and just get people's money, and that's not right. You know, unless you literally find out about it at the last minute and the guy doesn't get clearance or whatever the case may be, that's a different story. But by all accounts, they knew and they intentionally withheld that information so people would buy the pay-per-view and then screw them out of the match by not giving it to them. That's not right. 10 years ago this week, November 16th, 2003, Survivor Series in Dallas, Black Towel Kane, as I like to call him, defeated Shane McMahon in an ambulance match with a tombstone piledriver on the floor. What an epic feud Kane and Shane was back in 03. If any of you lived through it, certainly you remember the episode of Raw where Kane, I think, handcuffed Shane McMahon to the ring post and took some jumper cables to his nutsack. That was, of course, a memorable moment in Raw history. They also did an angle on this show where Mark Cuban, the owner of the Dallas Mavericks, who was sitting front row, got into the ring to confront Raw GM Eric Bischoff, and Cuban ended up getting laid out with an RKO from Randy Orton. Team Bischoff, which was Randy Orton, Chris Jericho, Scott Steiner, Christian, and Mark Henry, beat Team Austin, led by Shawn Michaels, Booker T, Rob Van Dam, and the Dudley Boys, in a traditional Survivor Series elimination match with Austin's career on the line, which meant he was forced to retire after the match, even though he was no longer an active wrestler by this point. He had wrestled what would turn out to be his final match earlier that year at WrestleMania against The Rock. This was a great, great match. This match right now, actually, is being shown on WWE Classics On Demand. So if you have that channel, if you subscribe, you can watch this match in full. I didn't watch this particular match last night. I was watching something else, but if you want to see it and you are a subscriber to the service, you could check it out, or else you could probably find it on YouTube. This was A match that went about half an hour. It's a great example of why they really need to add a traditional Survivors match to the card this year. Just the drama they played up with Shawn Michaels. He was bleeding like a stuck pig, hanging in there as long as he could. He knew Stone Cold's career was riding on him. But in the end, the odds were too much to overcome. I think Batista did a run-in and powerbombed him, and Orton pinned him. Austin did this really sincere speech after the match was over, talking about how he got started in Dallas. And so if his career has to come to an end, it's appropriate for it to end right back here in Dallas. He'd come full circle. He left some empty beer cans in the ring as he exited. Just great stuff. Maybe the last truly great Survivor Series-style match they ever did. Undertaker also wrestled Vince McMahon in a Buried Alive match on this show. And within the opening 60 seconds, maybe 90 seconds, and I'm not even exaggerating, Vince bladed, and he must have hit an artery because he was just bleeding all over the place. It was leaking out of his head, and the match just started. I'm shocked he didn't pass out as the match went on. I mean, I remember watching this and being legit concerned. The guy's 50-something years old. He just cut himself. He's bleeding all over the place. The match just started. If you figure they're going to be out there at least 10, 15 minutes. I thought for sure he was passing out. I still don't know how he didn't. Just the complete annihilation this match was until the very end when Kane helped bury his brother to build to an eventual match between the two at WrestleMania and paved the way for the return of the Dead Man. Or kind of like a Dead Man Biker Taker hybrid, I guess you would call it. This was the final appearance for Big Evil Biker Undertaker, for that character that Vince McMahon now likes to pretend never existed. 8 years ago this week, on November 13, 2005, I already devoted some time to this last week when I talked about his last match with Ken Anderson on SmackDown, but that was the date that Eddie Guerrero passed away, 8 years ago at the age of 38, found dead in his hotel room the same day he was scheduled to wrestle for the World Heavyweight title. He died of heart failure due to his history of drug and alcohol abuse. The medical examiner found the blood vessels in his heart to have narrowed so greatly from all of that abuse that his heart just couldn't take it anymore. You know, your heart works even more to pump blood, and yet the vessels get smaller and smaller, and that's just a recipe for death, which is what we saw here. 5 years ago this week, on November 16th, 2008, Brock Lesnar became the only man in history to hold the WWE Championship and the UFC Heavyweight title by beating Randy Couture, who JBL loves to name drop often on commentary. He beat him via TKO in the main event of UFC 91 in Las Vegas. And finally, 3 years ago this week, on November 15th, 2010, was the first ever episode of Old School Raw. I love this show. They had the old red, white, and blue ring ropes, the steel barricades, the interview platform with Mean Gene. They had an appearance by the Doctor of Style, Slick, and Jive Soul Bro, one of the all-time great theme songs. George the Animal Steel eating a turnbuckle pad. They had Mae Young referring to Michelle McCool and Layla as, and I quote, bitches and sluts. I believe the first and only Daniel Bryan match was on this show that Jim Ross ever called. It was against Jack Swagger. And a tremendous Piper's Pit segment to end the show, where Roddy Piper was very quietly and very calmly looking into John Cena's eyes, and he asked him not to spit in the face of all those legends that came before him. He said, "John Cena, don't you spit in my face, John Cena." And he was referring to the scenario. Cena was set to referee the Randy Orton-Wade Barrett title match at Survivor Series when Cena was forced to be a slave for the Nexus during that period. And Piper wanted him not to disrespect the title by helping Wade Barrett win it. There were so many subtle things, even from a production standpoint on this show, that I still maintain would still work today. You know, that I wish they would incorporate into the show. One thing, I don't know if they did it on this show, but they used to have these event center updates with Mean Gene or Todd Pettengill or whoever, you know, whoever it was, running down matches for the upcoming pay-per-view. Not this bullshit now where on the go-home show they have a shot of the announcers just sitting at their desk doing a quick rundown of the two matches they probably announced previously and then moving on. These just made the shows feel more special, but, you know. Then again, it's hard to do updates like that when you don't bother announcing most of the matches for your pay-per-views until 6 days beforehand. So I guess these just aren't practical anymore. If you have questions for the mailbag, email them to me, thesolomonster@gmail.com. I'm also on Twitter, so follow me, @solomonster is my handle, and we're on Facebook. We have a profile, we have a fan page, and we have a discussion group, a closed group. So type in the name of the show, you can apply for membership, and I will approve you. We are approaching 700 members, so we will soon have the 700 Club on Facebook, the only one that really matters. Facebook.com/TheSolomonster is the official profile page link, and you can certainly like our fan page as well. Subscribe to our channel on YouTube. We are approaching 5,000 subscribers. I hope you're one of them. Every time a new video goes up, if you are a subscriber, you will be notified. I don't know when the next one is going to go up, but there will be another video soon. You can find a bunch of reviews up there. I've got back-to-back 45-minute reviews, one of the Bob Holly book, The Hardcore Truth, another one for the Triple H Thy Kingdom Come DVD, and there's also some reviews for the Battleground pay-per-view, there's a review for Hell in a Cell. There won't be one for Survivor Series. I don't think I will have time for that, but there will be more videos going up in the future. And if you ever wanted to listen to the first 8 episodes of The Solomonster Sounds Off, if you weren't listening back in the day, all 8 episodes from 2007, okay, because the show started later in the year in November, all 8 episodes, episodes 1 through 8, are now available exclusively on our YouTube channel. My username is The Solomonster, all one word. So search us out, subscribe. You can listen to those early shows. Episode 9 will be going up at some point in the very near future. That'll be the first show, I guess, from 2008. I don't know what the hell was going on in wrestling at that time, but you'll be able to listen and find out very soon. I also just want to give a very quick shout-out to TV Tracks, who is a big supporter of the show. He will get clips from some of our episodes up on his channel and has really been a big champion of the podcast. A lot of people have been exposed to the show by listening to those brief clips on his channel, and now they listen to the full shows every week. So give his channel a look as well, TV Tracks, TVTRAX. And a big thank you, as usual, to him. And a thanks to you for listening over 2 hours, another 2 hour sound off. Don't get used to this, people. There just happened to be a lot of stuff to cover, a lot of ground to cover this week. We'll be back next weekend with Survivor Series predictions. I predict this show will do a poor buy rate. I'll have match predictions next week for that. Any other breaking news, that'll be episode 302. So until then, be well, stay safe, enjoy the week. We'll see you back here in 7.
You've been listening to The Solomonster Sounds Off, giving you the good.
Because I'm the man!
You don't shut your mouth, I am going to punch you in the face.
The bad.
You're going to prove to the world that all you are is a B-plus player.
And the ugly.
And then Hogan announces that he's going to defend the championship, Bully Ray is, against the same Sting who just 3 months ago lost a match where if he lost, he could never again get another title shot. What in the fuck just happened?
Well, mostly the good.
I can't get a break with Ace's name. I gotta get rid of this match. I gotta get out of this club. This club sucks.
Solomonster Sounds Off.
Since 2007, on thesolomonster.com, Stitcher Radio, and iTunes, The Solomonster Sounds Off.